All right, I think we will begin. My name is Joel Barkin, Senior Associate here at CSIS, and I want to welcome you all here this morning, particularly that given that the notice went out only yesterday afternoon, so you've made a special effort to be here, and also it's testimony to our speaker and the topic at hand. So there's both the push on your own part and the attraction of François Grillon. As you know, he is the director of the Africa Program at the International Crisis Group, where he oversees a number of countries, including the Horn, the situation in Chad, Zimbabwe, Kenya, DRC. He has quite a full plate. But what some of you may not know is that he has been a long-term resident of Kenya following his receipt of his PhD from Montesquieu University in Bordeaux in 1997. He went out to Nairobi, where he was the deputy director and research fellow at the French Institute for Research in Africa, a small French-sponsored think tank in Nairobi. And then after several years there, 3 years, he joined the International Crisis Group in 2000, where he spent 4 years. Then he left and joined MONUC in the Congo as a head of working in their analysis office for 2 years, and then he returned to the ICG in 2006, where he has been since that time. So he has operated out of Nairobi for a period of almost 12 years, knows the situation well. I might add that his wife, Koki Muli, was the head of the Institute for Education and Democracy, the leading domestic monitoring organization for both the 2002 elections and the 2007 elections. So he's intimately familiar with the situation in Kenya and also in Zimbabwe. Now, the two cases of Zimbabwe and Kenya are often compared. There are some obvious similarities. That is to say, an election where the results were fudged and where the apparent winner did not assume the presidency. But the events unfolding afterward in each country are significantly different, as is the unfolding role of the international community, and particularly, I might add, the role of the United States, which was substantial in the case of Kenya in perhaps two different directions, but Jean-François can discuss that. And then in Zimbabwe, where the U.S. Had virtually no leverage and played no significant role, although where a number of U.S.-based NGOs, including Freedom House and I believe NDI, since I see one of the representatives here, have been active. So François is going to compare and contrast the two for us this morning. We welcome you here and the fact that you've taken time out from your busy schedule to join us, and we particularly welcome all of you who came at short notice. Thank you again, and François, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. The topic I'm going to try and, you know, to address this morning is actually, I think, has become a fairly important one for Africa. We are, you know, the Kenya crisis and the Zimbabwe crisis are, I think, in many respects very different. But we came into a situation whereby attempts at their resolution, you know, took the shape of power to a certain extent similar power sharing agreements, where the logic was to try to cut down the executive powers of the president and bring in a prime minister from the opposition. Now, this is a very important issue because I think there are some lessons to be learned for the future, for other situations that could be similar. And some questions, of course, on principle do arise when we have these kind of situations. power sharing agreements, I mean, we need to ask ourselves whether a power sharing agreement actually might not make things worse in a way, and whether it is not a self-defeating approach, because what's the point of having elections if when the incumbent succeeds to rig himself in or refuses the results or blackmails his own country and the rest of the regional international community with violence, whether, you know, necessarily the approach should be to, in order to save lives, give in a power-sharing agreement. And if we discuss in detail the situation of Kenya and Zimbabwe, there are some elements there, which are actually quite important and quite striking. But beyond this issue, which I think remains a very important issue, and during the discussion, we could look, for instance, at what happened in Ghana, which was a great success. But we need to keep in mind that the opposition in Ghana won with 50,000 votes. That was a very close call. And what happened in Ghana, in fact, is very interesting as compared to Kenya or as compared to Zimbabwe, even though Zimbabwe is a bit different. But what happened in Ghana is that, contrary to Kenya, you had the mechanisms to actually prevent a Kenya scenario. You had an ability within the country to mitigate and mediate a possible, you know, scenario that would have led to tension or violence because of an election that came a very, very close call. So these are very important issues. It could happen again in other countries. It could happen again very much in Kenya. And unfortunately, I fear the current situation is not very promising. But beyond also the matters of principle, you know, is it right? Sometimes you have to deal with an emergency. You have to deal with indeed saving lives. You have to try and contain a situation in a matter of days. And a power-sharing agreement, in fact, is not satisfactory, but it helps contain the situation. It helps save lives. The question then is how do we make it, what are the objectives? What are, the logic behind power-sharing and how should this logic be sustained? The issue is the sustainability of a power-sharing agreement to reach the objectives, which, of course, are often to go for another election, are often to go to restore the rule of law and the democratic process, which was undermined by the violence. And in this respect, here also, I think, as far as Zimbabwe and Kenya are concerned, there are important issues on the table that needs to be raised and kept in mind by the policymakers, because it's not when the deal is signed, when a piece of paper actually broadly describes the division of labor between, a president or a prime minister, that we have a functional situation or we have a sustainable situation. And in fact, we are going to reach our objectives, which in the end is to restore the credibility of the electoral system, of the logic of a democratic process, and the possibility of a change of government. Because if, the logic is not to sustain to give benefits to the fraud, right? It's to try to put back an environment that will allow the expression of of the population's will to be respected. So these are, I think, very important and challenging issues that we need to address and they're very, of course, the cases of Kenya and Zimbabwe are very interesting to when it comes to deal with them. So we have indeed for these two countries two power sharing agreements, as I mentioned, with the creation of posts of for prime ministers coming from the officially defeated party. I mean, but in respect, we have, in fact, two incumbent presidents who were rigged in. And the opposition is brought in as a compensation to try to contain the situation. Beyond that, the cases of Kenya and Zimbabwe, of course, brought, at the center stage two very important figures of contemporary African politics, President Thabo Mbeki and Kofi Annan, to try to mediate and obtain, positive results on these two situations. And it is important because it also addresses, or it's also raised the issue on how to make it work and what, in fact, what were the key aspects that made the deal, that and what are the key elements to make it sustainable. The Southern Africa region was, through Thabo Mbeki, but by itself, you know, the framework of reference for the power-sharing deal, for all the entire negotiation process in Zimbabwe. And in Kenya, interestingly, it is, I believe, the region that made the deal. It's not Kofi Annan. It is Jakaya Kikwete. So these are, you know, issues which in terms of policymaking, in terms of making the most out of power-sharing deals when we have to go through, you know, these experiences, I think need to be, you know, need to be raised and need to be looked at very significantly. Now, very briefly, of course, we have two different situations in Kenya and Zimbabwe. In the case of Zimbabwe, the challenge is a challenge of, I would say, regime transformation. The Zimbabwe regime is very much the archetypal liberation regime that came out from the struggle with a very strong ideology and the creation of a very, very strong, very strongly driven regime where the ideology of the liberation, of the, you know, the fighting for freedom remained the driving force and as, in fact, it's not just, I think, be used as a justification. It remains a very important matter and a very important issue even now for the most, you know, the hardliners of the regime in the secret sector. Yes, of course, currently they are in a position where they feel threatened by the power sharing, and they, as in the, you know, we published a report yesterday which outlines the main threat in Zimbabwe coming from those areas. But we should not forget that the liberation, you know, discourse is not just a figure of speech. It's something which resonates very, very strongly both in Zimbabwe and Southern Africa. And the challenge of transformation from a liberation movement controlling the state, where the party basically, you know, the party drives strongly ZANU-PF, the state, where the state becomes an instrument of the party. Now, to transform a situation like that towards a more open society, a society whereby there is a possibility, if Zimbabwean decides that, in fact, an alternative political force takes over, I think was the main issue in Zimbabwe, which we find today in other countries. We find it in Angola, we find it in Uganda, we might find it in Rwanda in a few years. You know, this is not something which, in fact, when we look at Zimbabwe, we shouldn't look at something of the past. You know, it's, in fact, you know, Mugabe is a dinosaur. And the challenges in terms of the process which is happening is still very relevant for a number of countries. In Kenya, it's a different pattern, of course. In Kenya, we have a situation where it's the challenge of a much more open society, a much more open political system, which went through different phases of, I would say, democratic transformation and made major progress in this respect. Nobody would doubt that, you know, if you look at the 92 elections, the first multi-party elections, and then 97, and then 2002, you see, in fact, an enormous progress in the level of freedom. And the most remarkable process that we should never forget about Kenya is that the changeover between Daniel Arap Moi and Mwai Kibaki was totally peaceful and, you know, happened in the total absence of violence in a very, very democratic and democratic way. Now, Daniel Arap Moi was not the candidate, and to a certain extent, you know, KANU had already sealed its fate in the way it managed the electoral process. But Kenya found itself, like probably other countries who went through similar processes or are going to face similar processes of you know, consolidating state authority beyond the opening up, beyond freedom, beyond the freedom of the press, the building of a civil society, consolidating its situation to meet the challenge also of ethnic politics and build institutions, because what we had in Kenya were, in fact, the culmination of a process, I think, of the collapse of state authority in the country and the attrition of state authority. And this is another type of challenge which is now, which number of countries are facing, that Côte d'Ivoire faced in a very dramatic way, leading to an open conflict, but that you have maybe in Zambia, maybe in Ghana, although it was met successfully, and that you may have with Cameroon and others. So, and which will happen every time you have this, this situation where power may change hands. So I would like to come back to these two points I made in introduction. Do we need absolutely to give in power sharing if there is a contested election and the incumbent refuses to accept the result? Is it necessary the best, option on their alternatives? That's something which is important. And then the second point I would like to raise is that, okay, once we have made that decision, there is a process of negotiation taking place. What are the lessons that needs to be kept in mind for the objectives of the power sharing to remain on course and the sustainability of this power sharing to be guaranteed, or at least to be consolidated? First of all, were there alternatives both in Kenya and Zimbabwe? Well, interestingly, the first mediation attempt, which started immediately after the announcement of the result in Nairobi by the electoral chair, Samuel Kivuitu, which was led very discreetly by some embassies with the help of Colin Bruce, the representative of the bank, World Bank, who started a shuttle, very discreet shuttle and very quiet shuttle between the parties to try to take the situation under control. Put the situation under control. This initial negotiation didn't go for a power sharing agreement. The proposal was to review the results and to find alternative solutions to try to restore the credibility of the electoral process. So to go back to the election process, review the results, and agree on a process to basically, based on an audit of the elections, make the appropriate decisions afterwards. But it brought the process back to the fact that Kibaki was not legitimately elected, and we needed to go back to the issue of legitimacy and to the issue of the validity of the election results. The logic of Kofi Annan was totally different. I'm not passing a judgment here. The situation was also totally different, because when Kofi Annan came in on 21st January in Nairobi, 700 or 800 people had died. 3 weeks before, the violence had started, but the escalation had not reached these proportions. However, this attempt failed in Kenya. It failed for not because, in fact, there was not an initial, agreement. There was a deal which was brokered, and there was an agreement. It was not signed, but Kibaki had given in. Kibaki had agreed. And then the second week of January, saw a reversal of situation whereby the hardliners around Kibaki convinced him to reject the agreement to come back, to the electoral process, to have an audit of the results, and to agree on mechanisms that would, allow the truth or let's say the validity of the electoral process to be restored. And when you may remember, if you followed this closely, when the chair then of the African Union, John Kufuor, jetted in Nairobi, in fact he was there to endorse and sign and witness the signature of this agreement. It didn't happen. And Kufuor was there for 2 days, and then, his term, I think, as chair was for another month, because the next summit of the African Union was a few weeks, maybe not for a month, maybe 2 weeks. I mean, the summit was just a few weeks away. and didn't want to get involved, you know. So he decided to withdraw, not to really intervene, and to ask Kofi Annan to take over a mediation. But I'm raising this to illustrate the fact that there was a possibility of an alternative. The environment, I would say, basically, the bottom line was the pressure on the parties, and in particular on the hardliners around Kibaki, was not strong enough for them. You know, they fought back and they succeeded to dismiss this initial agreement. Very interestingly, this deal was partly brokered and supported by the business community in Kenya. They were mobilized very quickly, and they intervened, you know, directly with Kibaki to try and avoid what they understood very quickly would be an economic disaster for their own interests. And I'm talking about the Kikuyu establishment here, not, you know, representative of multinationals, but businessmen who have directly a stake in their own country and see their own business threatened. So in the end, you know, it didn't happen. And if we see the situation in Zimbabwe, we published a report, Crisis Group published a report in December last year, where we advocated, in fact, for dropping the power-sharing agreement and establishing a transitional administration that would be led by the technocrat, and the political drivers of the transition, which would be a short transition leading to new elections, would have been parliament. Because, interestingly, in both elections, if there is one election, few, you know, really, the results of which are not challenged, it is a parliamentary election. And there are more problems, I think, with the parliamentary results in Kenya than in Zimbabwe. There was some fraud with a number of MPs also, but to a certain extent, there is a large consensus that the parliamentary election represented the will of the people. So in Zimbabwe, I think the situation in the end, the MDC gave in because it had no plan B and no other option. And the economic meltdown of the country was hitting the MDC probably even harder than it was hitting the constituencies of ZANU-PF. The pressure of the region was also quite strong on the MDC. And inside the MDC, the internal pressure to give in a deal became also fairly strong. I mean, the MDC didn't have the internal resources to continue the fight, the internal capacity, both, I think, strategically and, the party had since 2000, seen, you know, been hit systematically and was running really a situation where, I had no plan B. As you may remember, the mass action cause never met, I mean, for 2 or 3 years had not met any really resonance in the country. The economy, the collapse of the economy was too strong. But I think alternatives were possible, and they remain possible. And what we put on the table in December, it was dismissed by some as politically unrealistic. But if you look at it, we were calling, I mean, obviously Robert Mugabe would not have stepped down, but we were calling for an arrangement which, in fact, provided an alternative solution. In particular, the political driver, I think, would have been found in Parliament, would have been found through the elected representative, and because in Parliament you had, you know, this legitimate political forces being represented with a slight majority from the MDC, but a slight majority means that they would have had to work together in support of a transitional administration. Anyway, this did not happen. However, and in the case of Ghana, and just one quick word about Ghana, because it was, I recently attended an African mediators retreat organized by the Center for Humanitarian Dialogue, whereby we discussed those issues, because of course they are at the heart of, you know, mediators' work. And it's very interesting to see that in Ghana, when the count started to show that, you know, for the second round, the margin was going to be extremely small, extremely limited. And in fact, of course, in this kind of situation, the tension is very high, and the possibility of fraud, you know, comes up, and the incumbent doesn't see himself as, you know, agreeing to give in, you know, to give in, I mean, to accept defeat if he doesn't have guarantees that there is, you know, it's a legitimate defeat. So we have a situation whereby to avoid a scenario that may not have been, you know, similar to Kenya, but to avoid a crisis that could turn into violence, national institutions, and here there was an institution devoted to conflict prevention and mitigation of electoral tensions, run by, I think it was a bishop, an archbishop, who actually immediately, before the announcement of the results, started to go and talk to the leader of the opposition, the head of the electoral commission, the head of state, and build a process to manage the situation, to make sure that they were managing their troops, they were managing their supporters in a way, and in fact to guarantee that, you know, as the tension built up, they would not be tempted to reject the results, and that even from the electoral commission part, it would not, you know, you wouldn't have the situation where Samuel Kivuyu come in front of national television and says, my returning officers have disappeared, they are not sending me the results, and I don't know what's happening. I mean, and then during the night, you know, they agree that the results have serious problem of credibility, but nevertheless the following morning announces that there is a winner. So we have, I think, a situation in Ghana where it shows also that even if there is tension, even if there is a potential crisis brewing, and during this moment, these times, if there is enough prevention work, preparatory work to avoid a crisis scenario, it can happen, and the democratic process can be respected. Now, of course, in this environment, the role of the African Union and the region plays an important role, and it's absolutely key. And that's a reflection in terms of their action, which you know, is at the heart, I think, of you know, policy making by these institutions in particular, because it goes beyond just, you know, after a coup condemning, or if there is a fraudulent result, you know, condemning. It's about avoiding such a scenario. Now, to come back to the second issue, and to come back to Kenya and Zimbabwe, I think there are two particular factors which needs to be taken into consideration once we have, once, when I say we, once, you know, there has been a mediation to try to broker a deal and avoid violence, the continuation of violence. Because, of course, objective number one is to try to avoid, to stop the violence, and objective number two is to try to put back on track the restoration of rule of law and of democratic process. And in this respect, both situations, Zimbabwe and Kenya, are striking, but I mean striking by, I would say, the question marks that one could raise about, you know, the fact that the violence may have been stopped for good, and the fact that, indeed, the reform agenda is going to come strongly out of this transition process, that there will have been reforms guaranteeing that the next time it's not going to happen again. Both in Zimbabwe, I think, and Kenya, the guarantees that those two factors had been addressed are pretty limited. And I would like to here just raise, I think, 4 points which are important, and that we can, lessons which can be learned maybe from the situation in Kenya and Zimbabwe. I am more optimistic about Zimbabwe than Kenya. And this will come as a surprise maybe to all of you, because both deals, to a certain extent, are bad, you know, in terms, they are unbalanced. They are, in fact, unclear. The institutional setup provided in the Zimbabwe environment creates, in fact, a dual, you know, structure of power. It creates more confusion than anything else within the you know, within government. And in Kenya, the reality is, even though Raila Odinga has the official responsibility to supervise and coordinate the government, you know, ministers who don't belong to ODM actually report directly to the president, the chief of the, I mean, the head of civil service, Francis Mudaura, is much stronger in terms of control of the instruments of power than Raila Odinga himself. So, you know, the institutional setup remains also weak. But the four issues I would like to, the 4 points which are important, I think, are, number one, what is the, when you negotiate such a power sharing agreement, we need to think about beyond the institutional setup, what's going to make this deal happen, this deal being implemented, and what's going to be, make it, what you know, what is the success? What is going to make it sustainable? Here, in Kenya, the initial driving force for the signature was the agreement that the tandem, Raila Odinga, Mwai Kibaki, you know, would take the lead, would be the driving force, would be, they would make things happen. And if you may remember the way it was negotiated, it was, it, I mean, the deal was only signed because Raila Odinga and Mwai Kibaki were isolated together in one room with Jakaya Kikwete, Benjamin Mkapa, and Kofi Annan for 4 hours. It was on a Thursday morning. The previous Monday, everything was in tatters. Martha Karua from PNU had insulted Benjamin Mkapa and Kofi Annan during the negotiations, rejected the mediation. Kofi Annan had to suspend the talks, and nothing had happened with the two negotiating teams, you know, on the Tuesday and the Wednesday. But it took President Kikwete to come to Nairobi and some, you know, robust diplomacy on Kibaki in particular from the part of Tanzania to have this result on the Thursday by lunchtime. And those of you who were in Kenya or had the possibility to see maybe on international media the signature or the faces of either Martha Karua or Moses Wetangula, you know, on TV, they were obviously at a burial. Their faces was like, you know, they were livid, livid. That deal was not welcome by the members of PNU. Moses Wetangula was going around the bars in Nairobi the same evening saying, you know, we are going to take this down. We are going to shoot it down. The Minister for Foreign Affairs. So the driving force was the capacity of the two men to work together. And is that sufficient? I think that's a question we need to ask right now, because neither of them, in fact, are in control of party structures which are coherent, cohesive, disciplined, organized, or have the same motivations. Traditional Kenyan politics, coalitions are formed, I mean, you know, integrate and disintegrate as per short-term interest, depending on what are the best outcome, you know, you can get from siding with one side or the other. But, you know, all Kenyan politicians belong to one camp or the other. If you look over 10 years of politics, they will have probably been, you know, all over the place. And it's true also for ODM. ODM is a loose coalition of individuals. I mean, the famous Pentagon, you know, soon after the deal was in fact in trouble because, you know, the sharing of the posts, that was the challenge for them to keep some cohesion beyond the speech on the reform agenda. So, and the problem is that neither Kibaki nor Raila have control over their troops, right? And even right now, you have a situation where you have cross-party, you know, defeat of government members. For instance, on the vote of no confidence against the Minister for Agriculture, William Ruto, brought in by the former Justice Minister Martha Karua in Parliament, the main defender of Ruto was Kerai Tumurungi from PNU. Most interesting, you know, he defends the ODM minister. Why? Because, of course, he's next as far as corruption is concerned. You had Kenya was facing two enormous crises, the maize shortage and the supply of oil, of fuel shortage. So here, I mean, we politically, I think that's an important question. And in this respect, we have now in a situation in Kenya where, you know, questions are being raised about the capacity of Mwai Kibaki to continue playing his part as one a key, you know, part of the engine, you know, being the driving force behind this grand coalition. Simultaneously, Raila Odinga is facing not only internal challenges, but it's also, you know, his commitment to the reform agenda is being questioned. So when the two heads or the two key elements, which are the only ones that you are supposed to, you know, drive the process and drive the reform agenda and make sure the violence doesn't happen, in fact, are not working together anymore, or are just abandoning, you know, the objective, you have a serious problem. And that's the situation we have now in Kenya. But there are, although, of course, other institutions. What about parliament? And interestingly, I think in Zimbabwe, for instance, in this briefing we see that we think that parliament is a key agent for change. The current situation in Zimbabwe, as far as the executive is concerned, you know, is that actually it could have been worse, because although there is a high degree of provocation from the hardliners of ZANU-PF who are continuing with their policy of harassment and torture on some MDC activists with the farm invasions, etc., as a provocation to try to, you know, test and push, in fact, have the inclusive government collapse, you also have a degree of cooperation from civil servants, from ZANU-PF appointees, and also in parliament, which I think shows that the driving force for change in Zimbabwe is, or for reforms, is probably, you know, stronger than it is in Kenya. And it is also supported by the fact that I think the humanitarian plus approach from the international partners, you know, which has already started, has given room for maneuver to the MDC. And it's been implemented in a way which was, I would say, non-sectarian or non-unnecessary politicized. I have, the time is flying, so I will just raise the three other issues I mentioned as far as the power sharing agreement concerned. Another important aspect which needs to be seen is the issue of, you know, the drivers of violence. These have to be addressed if you want to meet your objectives. And in Kenya, the drivers of the logic behind the violence, drivers of the violence, the vigilantes on the ground, in the Rift Valley, in the slums, have not been addressed. They are being kept to be recycled for the next election, to put it bluntly. And that's an enormous concern. In Zimbabwe, the state, of course in Kenya also, the state was one of the drivers of the violence, but in Zimbabwe, the state is the driver of violence. And here again, I think progressively, provided the other aspect of the policy we are putting in this briefing is addressed, which is basically a discrete negotiation with the hardliners the security leaders to make sure that, you know, they do not take this government down, or to prevent, in fact, the risk of an assassination of Morgan Tsvangirai or some other leaders of the MDC. Provided such an effort is made by partners and by, you know, and the region is alerted to that risk, the region intervenes to preserve the government, I think the driving of the violence, drivers of the violence in Zimbabwe can be controlled in a much, you know, more efficient way. And it comes, in fact, to the role of the region and the role of the guarantors of the deal. Again, in Zimbabwe, I think SADC has a vested interest in seeing this process succeed. It is their process. They imposed it on the MDC to a certain extent. They have a vested, and South Africa in particular, they have a vested interest in seeing the restoration of the democratic process in Zimbabwe, not just that ZANU-PF remains in power. I think beyond that now, SADC would be, you know, would not agree to see the government being taken down or to see the MDC becoming the victim of the hardliners and UPF once they have agreed, in fact, their logic. They have given in their logic. That argument can be challenged, and I'm happy to discuss it in the course of our discussion. But in the case of Kenya, who are the guarantors? Kofi Annan left the process without any follow-up mechanism, any follow-up structures, without any appeal mechanism, but also no role for international partners, no role for the African Union or the region, no review of where we were, what are the benchmarks, and how do we move forward. No external authority, or even without, you know, calling on external authority, no role for a possible ombudsman. And in fact, to a certain extent, the direct outcome of this, I would say, weakness of the agreement and of the mediation is that the mediation has become almost irrelevant now. You saw the difficulty that that Kofi Annan had to bring the party together and agree on a review process. They are dismissing. After the Geneva conference on Kenya, there was an attempt to have both parties come to a retreat where they would, in fact, review the progress made and what are the challenges, etc. It collapsed after a day. They could not even agree on the agenda. Last point I would like to raise is the issue of the cost and incentives. I think, dramatically, in Kenya, the issue of accountability was thrown out the window. And of course, Philip Waki did a wonderful work in the current Kenyan environment, because with this envelope of names that he gave to Kofi Annan with a mission to give it to the ICC for prosecution, a process which in fact puts the issue of accountability on the table. But realistically, we also know that the ICC has a plate full and is not such an efficient institution anyway, and it takes, if you look at its track record in the Congo, it's not like it is, it can deliver justice or anything else for that matter in a short amount of time or before any other new election. And it cannot operate without a degree of cooperation from the state involved. So the issue of accountability, of course, has been raised in Kenya during the negotiations, some travel ban imposed, in particular by the US and also by Canada, on some individuals, which I think contributed to keep the pressure on. But the risk is that we have had the Waki report, there is a law for a Truth and Justice Commission, but in fact, nothing really, the issue of justice and accountability is not being delivered. And when you see that, for instance, with the law for the truth for the Justice and Truth and Justice Commission, ministers who are called in to testify will not leave their positions. They will not be suspended if they are suspected to have been actively involved in the violence. They will keep their position with the possibility, in fact, to organize, I would say, very little protection for those who might testify against them. You have an environment where the issue of accountability and the issue of the cost on stalling the process, is coming back as a weakness. In Zimbabwe, the external pressure, of course, is hugely controversial, but it has had some impact. It's not been extremely, effective in a way, but it has had, I think, some impact into raising the stakes for the establishment of ZANU-PF. And although this is debatable, I believe that incentives are necessary, but there must be a cost for those responsible for the violence, and accountability mechanisms have to be part of the solution. Otherwise, and that's my word of conclusions, the objectives, which is really to try to bring, not only, number one, to prevent any new outburst of violence or to stop the violence, and number two, to bring back the process to a situation of, to restore the rule of law and bring the democratic process back on track, these objectives, are extremely difficult to meet. Thank you.